Exodus chapter 31, verse 12 to chapter 32, verse 20. The 30th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on September 24, 2017 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 28, Exodus 31:12 to 32:20, accompanies this talk.
We'll be continuing in the book of Exodus. There's a little bit that I didn't finish last week, that this part of the instructions that God gave to Moses. So I'm going to finish that part, so that'll be the first few minutes of today's. And then I'm going to start in on the incident with the golden calf. So Exodus chapter 31, verses 12 through 17. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "But as for you, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, 'You shall surely observe my Sabbaths. For this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. Therefore, you are to observe the Sabbath, for it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it shall surely be put to death. For whoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people. For 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day there is a Sabbath of complete rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall surely be put to death. So the sons of Israel shall observe the Sabbath to celebrate the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the sons of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, but on the seventh day he ceased from labor and was refreshed." So this is, if I have not mistaken, this is the third time that God has talked about the Sabbath in the book of Exodus. Laying down the rules with respect to the Sabbath and encouraging the people to observe it. In this section, it calls it a sign between God and his people. And I'm not sure exactly in what sense it is a sign, but it seems to be in the sense of being a reminder. It is something that they are to observe, and the observance of that day will help them both to remember and to understand what God has in store for them. It says specifically that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. So this weekly observance of the Sabbath is a reminder that God is a sanctifier of the people, is the sanctifier of the people of Israel. And that they, that is the people of Israel, need to be holy in order to play the role that God wants them to play. This is a serious matter. God wants them to take this very seriously. He says, anyone who violates the Sabbath will be put to death, cut off from his people. He reiterates that they are to work for 6 days, rest on the seventh, and points out that this is to be a perpetual commandment throughout your generations. So it's serious, and it is permanent. And the reason for them to celebrate the Sabbath on a weekly basis is an imitation of what God did at the act of creation. He worked for 6 days, and he rested on the seventh and was refreshed. it is worthy of note, I think, that the first thing that God made holy, that we have recorded as God making holy, was the Sabbath. He made the Sabbath holy in Genesis chapter 2. But here we have a discussion of the tabernacle, another thing that is holy. Why would God put this little reminder to keep the Sabbath at the end of the instructions that God is giving to Moses with respect to the tabernacle and the priests? Cassuto, Umberto Cassuto, he says, it's because the people are just about to build the tabernacle, and it's important that they not violate this law when they're building God's tent. That is, in their enthusiasm, they need to be careful not to work on the Sabbath. I'm dubious. I don't think that's a very good accounting for why the mention of the Sabbath here. I'm not sure exactly why it's mentioned here, but I think it is worthy of note that the tabernacle and the Sabbath have a lot in common. The Sabbath is holy space in time. The tabernacle is holy space in geography. They are both reminders of two very important truths. The first is that God is holy, and the second is it is God that makes holy. And it's worthy of note, as we proceed through the text, that we're just about to get into the text where it talks about the incident with the golden calf. When that section is concluded, the first thing that Moses talks about is keeping the Sabbath, once again. Verse 18 of the same chapter. And when he had finished speaking with him upon Mount Sinai, he gave Moses the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone written by the finger of God. The account makes it sound like God prepared this tablet at the very beginning, but God seems to hold the tablets back, and now when he's all done talking to Moses, now he hands the tablets over to Moses. And it stresses two things. One is that these tablets are made of stone, I think stressing the permanence of the content on these tablets. And the second is, it's written by the finger of God. God himself authored this law that has been written in a permanent form. Okay, now we can get into the incident with the golden calf. So as you'll recall, it was after the people of Israel had sealed their contract, their covenant with God, that they would be obedient to him, and he would be their God, and that they would be his people. It was after that they sealed that covenant then that Moses went up on the mountain. Oh, let me, I skipped my introduction to this little section, and I think I ought not skip that. As I was studying through these chapters, it was a couple months ago, as I was studying through these next three chapters, I was surprised. I was surprised at how powerful they were. It made me reflect a great deal. So I'm going to slow down here. There's a lot to talk about. The actual incident with the golden calf is just this first chapter, but then there are things that continue after that for two more chapters. My outline for this chapter was like 12 or 13 pages, and I can't talk that fast. So I divided it up into two, and I'm going to do half of it today and half of it next week, hopefully. There are two things that really stood out at me this time through it. The first one is that it seems to me, now having looked at it carefully, that the transgression of the Israelites is more serious and more subtle than I had previously realized. It's a very disturbing thing that they did. It's disturbing because it's terrible, but also it's so easy to see how they did it. And we are vulnerable to the same thing. And in order to understand that, one needs to see this incident in the context of the whole book of Exodus. And that's, I think that's critical and very helpful. The other thing that I recognize going through it this time is what an amazing man Moses was. Truly amazing. Much more so than if you just take the first part of Exodus, in my opinion. Okay. So Moses is the one that is, it's concern about him that gets this whole thing, that gets this thing started. After they had eaten their meal, sealing the deal with God, God called Moses up to the mountaintop. So Moses, he went up to meet with God in the cloud at the top of the mountain. He's been gone for 40 days, and the people are trying to figure out what happened. Why isn't he back? And there is good reason for them to be concerned. He's been gone for 40 days. There's no indication that he took water or food. He may have, but even if he did, how much did he take? 40 days is a long time. And they know that he went into a scary environment. That there's the cloud on the mountain, there's the earthquakes, there's the thundering voice of God, et cetera, et cetera. So after 40 days, the people are thinking, he must be dead. He'd have come back before this if something terrible hasn't happened to him. And there's a sense in which that's not an unreasonable guess as to what happened. Okay, let's read the first six verses of chapter 32. Now when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled about Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us a God who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And Aaron said to them, "Tear off the gold rings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." Then all the people tore off the gold rings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he took this from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. And they said, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought us up from the land of Egypt." Now when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord." So the next day they rose early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. So the people are worried about what has happened to Moses and speculating something terrible has happened. So what they do is they come to Aaron, and the wording when it says the people assembled about Aaron, that phrase, they assembled about Aaron, has a connotation of being hostile. So they are gathering around Aaron in a threatening kind of way. And they say to him, "Make us a God." This is their solution to the problem of Moses disappearing. Come, make us a God who will go before us. The word that's used here for God is the Hebrew word Elohim. And I'm going to have to talk a little bit about grammar here in order to understand what's happening. Elohim has an ending, im, which in Hebrew is a plural ending. Just as we have dog and dogs, the S at the end makes that plural. The im at the end makes a Hebrew noun, plural. So the word that is used in the Old Testament in talking about the pagan gods is Elohim. That's the word that's used when they say, when they're talking about pagan gods. But that word is also used in the Old Testament to refer specifically to God Yahweh, the one true God. And the reason for the plural form is that the plural can mean things other than just more than one. The plural form can also have the connotation of majesty. And there are a number of other words where the im ending suggests that sense of majesty. One example is heaven in Hebrew, Shemayim. And there's a dual ending, but the ending is thought to be to indicate majesty. Not that there's more than one, but that this thing has majesty. So Elohim is used to refer to God Yahweh. However, almost always, when Elohim is used in reference to the one true God, the verb is singular. But if Elohim is used to refer to the gods, then it uses a plural verb. Okay, does that make sense? The thing that's interesting about this particular passage is that when they refer to Elohim in this passage, they use a plural verb, which suggests that they're talking about the pagan gods, not Yahweh. I should point out, however, that there are a handful of instances in the Old Testament where Elohim clearly refers to Yahweh, but a plural verb comes with it. That's just to make things complicated. I think that what we are to understand in this particular instance is that whatever they're thinking that they see as a solution to their problem, they're thinking paganly. And I'll talk more about that later. They want a God who will go before us. So they want divine guidance and protection. They're afraid. They know that things have been difficult up to now, and now they're in the middle of the desert. There are a lot of threats that are out there, and they want divine guidance and protection that Yahweh has provided. But now they don't have Moses to secure that help and protection. They need access to divine assistance without Moses. Moberly, he's an author who wrote an entire book on these three chapters. It's a good book, by the way. The people's request for Elohim on the grounds that Moses has now disappeared is notable in that it implies that the Elohim are a replacement in some sense for Moses. Moses has been the unique mediator for the people to God. He's the only one. He's the only one with direct access to God. But clearly, he was not appreciated by the people and is not particularly missed. No one suggests, let's send a search party out for Moses. There's little concern for Moses himself, which is, I think, is very interesting. So they see the making of a calf, of an image, as being the preferable means to procuring divine assistance. They're thinking very paganly here. They're thinking very much like an Egyptian would think. We need divine help, and therefore we need to make an image. I will talk much more about this next week, but there is security in the conventional, and that's what they're looking for. They're looking for security in the way that the tried and true ways in which people do things, and if they need God's assistance, then they'll do it in the pagan fashion. Okay. They use the term, this Moses. I'm not positive, but my sense is that this is a disrespectful kind of address, term, to associate with Moses. This Moses fellow is kind of the idea, I think. It's interesting, they say that he is the one who brought them out of Egypt. They don't credit Yahweh in this particular instance. And they say, we don't know what happened to him. They, what's implied, though, is they don't much care what happened to him. What they're concerned about is their own well-being. So it's Aaron, they've come to Aaron threateningly, ask him to make them a god, because Moses is gone. Aaron capitulates to their request, to their demand. According to the rabbinic tradition, when it says that Aaron instructed them to tear out the earrings and to collect them and to tear them out of the ears of wives and sons and daughters, Aaron was trying to make it costly, make it difficult for them. And he was trying to delay and avoid having to do what they were requesting. I don't know if that's the case or not. But he took those earrings and he cast a calf from the metal. Now I should point out, it uses the term calf, that's the word that's usually used in English to refer to this incident, but the word means a young male bull. That it's a bull in the height of its physical strength. So it's not just a cute calf. We're talking about a powerful animal. And the way that they made idols in that time was to build a wooden frame and then metal, gold or silver, was cast over that, just a layer of a veneer. And then the artist would go in and do some fine carving on that metal to give it the details that would not otherwise be there. And that description of how they made idols fits well with what it says that Aaron did. Once he had made this golden calf and sets it before the people of Israel, they say, God, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Now, in my notes, I have he calls the calf the God that brought you out, but it should be they. They called it the calf that brought you out of Egypt. So they are associating this image with the God who brought them out of Egypt. But they're referring to this God that brought him out of Egypt as Elohim, And they're using consistently a plural verb with it. Moses, or Aaron, then, he sees what they've, how they're responding to this image. And my take on it is that Aaron is a little bit concerned. He's concerned that what he wanted to do was not understood by the people of Israel. And I'll talk more about this next week. But I think Aaron was trying to put this in the most theologically palatable form that he could possibly put it in. That what he wanted them to be doing is worshiping Yahweh, the true God. And yet what they are wanting to do is revert to pagan-like attitudes and practices, and they are treating this like any other idol. It's just an idol to them. Aaron then is trying to put the spin on this that's most acceptable. He says, tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord, to Yahweh. So he's specifying God, Yahweh. They had not done so in any of their statements. So there is a festival then to this calf. And interestingly, the things that they do with respect to this calf correspond to the things that they did when they sealed the covenant with God, with Yahweh. They rose early in both instances. They offered burnt offerings in both instances. They offered peace offerings in both instances. They ate and drank in both instances. It's only in the last element that there is a difference. And it says, and rose up to play. And that's particularly, that particularly stands out because the word for to play here has a connotation of committing adultery. So to play can, in certain contexts, have that connotation. And I think that connotation is intended here. There are other indications throughout this text that the author is likening what happened with the golden calf to an act of adultery. The next section. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, go down at once, for your people whom you brought up from the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded them. They have made for themselves a molten calf, and have worshipped it, and have sacrificed to it, and said, this is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, they are an obstinate people. Now then, let me alone, that my anger may burn against them, and that I may destroy them, and I will make of you a great nation. So God's aware of what has happened. And he tells Moses, I want you to go down. There are bad things happening. And in saying this, God indicates that he is disassociating himself from the people of Israel. He refers to them as your people. It's the old trick that parents play, whose child is it when it's disobedient? So they're your people, Moses. And there is the question at this point, can they continue to be God's people? That's the question that's at issue here. Okay. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see that God walks this back as time goes on. We'll see it in verse 14 that the Israelites are described as his people. And we'll see that God is going to slowly relent from what he first intends. He also says, whom you brought out of Egypt, not saying that it's his doing, but Moses' doing. So this is Moses' people and the product of Moses' work. God isn't indicating he has anything to do with these people. God lists the various things that they have done. They've corrupted themselves. They have turned away from the way I commanded. They made a molten calf. They worshiped it. They sacrificed to it. And they said, this is your God who brought you out of Egypt. And all of this, only 40 days from when they agreed to be obedient to God and to be his people. That's how long it took for them to go astray. So God is resolved to destroy them. God has seen this people. They are an obstinate people, and he's going to destroy them. There are three parts to his plan here. The first is he tells Moses not to interfere. He says, now then, let me alone. Don't interfere. Which is interesting because in that is an implication that God is susceptible to changing his mind. If he says, let me alone, go away, there is the hint that maybe if Moses were to stay, that Moses could change God's mind. And I suspect that Moses took note of this. God says he's going to destroy the people. That's the second part of the plan. And the third is, he is going to make Moses into the progenitor of his people. So much like he did with Abraham in the book of Genesis, where he came to Abraham and he said, I will make you into a great people, a great nation. Now he's saying, I've had it with these people at the bottom of the mountain. I'm gonna start over. I'm gonna start with you, Moses, and I'm gonna make you the progenitor of my people. So this is God's plan B that he's threatening to implement. Exodus 32:11. Then Moses entreated the Lord his God and said, O Lord, why doth thine anger burn against thy people, whom thou hast brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, with evil intent he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them from the face of the earth? Turn from thy burning anger and change thy mind about doing harm to thy people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, thy servants to whom thou didst swear by thyself, and didst say to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven, and all this land of which I have spoken I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. So the Lord changed his mind about the harm which he said he would do to his people. Moses doesn't do what he was told to do. He said, leave me alone. God said, leave me alone, Moses. Moses didn't. Moses stayed behind. And notice, Moses' appeal is there is absolutely nothing about the virtues of the people of Israel. He doesn't say, oh, they only did it this one time, or it's only a little thing, or they're basically good people, they just slipped up, or there's nothing like that. So God changing his mind is not based on some virtue in the people of Israel. The entire appeal that Moses makes is to the nature of God's character. He points out that God has done a whole bunch for these people already. Now do you really want to destroy them? He talks about what the Egyptians would think, that God had just brought them out here with evil intent so that they would die in the desert, and that would reflect poorly on God. And then positively he says, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. Remember the patriarchs. And the promises that God made to those patriarchs to make them into his people and give the land, the promised land, to their descendants forever. So on the basis of those appeals, God then relents, changes his mind about the harm which he had said he would do to his people. God decides, I will not destroy them. It becomes clear from the rest of the chapter that that's all that God changed his mind about at this point. Up to this point, all God is saying is, okay, I won't destroy them. Does that mean that the relationship between the people of Israel and God has been restored? No. There are going to be two more times that Moses is going to appeal to God before the relationship is fully restored. It's going to be a lot of work on Moses' part before the relationship is restored. Next section, 15 through 20. Then Moses turned and went down from the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, tablets which were written on both sides. They were written on one side and the other. And the tablets were God's work, and the writing was God's writing engraved on the tablets. Now when Joshua heard the sound of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, "There is a sound of war in the camp." But he said, "It is not the sound of the cry of trumpet, nor is it the sound of the cry of defeat, but the sound of singing I hear." I'll go a little further. And it came about, as soon as Moses came near the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing. And Moses' anger burned, and he threw the tablets from his hands and shattered them at the foot of the mountain. And he took the calf which they had made and burned it with fire and ground it to powder and scattered it over the surface of the water and made the sons of Israel drink it. Okay, so Moses goes down the hill with the tablets, goes back to the camp, and it talks in great detail about those two tablets. These are the tablets of the testimony. These tablets are written on both sides, and the writing is the work of God. It's engraved by God. Interestingly, the word engraved here is the same word that was used when it described what Aaron was doing to finish the calf. The golden calf had been cast, and then he engraved it. He did the detail work in it. So I suspect that what's being contrasted here is the making of the idol by Aaron and now the writing that God did of the law on the tablets. It says that Joshua heard the people. This is the first mention we've seen of Joshua with respect to this particular, since the time that they went up the mountain. It wasn't apparent before that Joshua had gone up the mountain with Moses, but now it becomes apparent that that was the case. Joshua had been Moses' right hand. We've seen that right-hand man. We've seen that before. And that this is more evidence of that reality. Joshua hears the shouting as the people are dancing and singing. Joshua hears that. And so Joshua hears this sound coming from the distance. And he's trying to figure out what is this sound and what does it indicate. And Joshua's best guess is that it is the sound of war in the camp. It's not, of course. This is the people singing and dancing, and this is the sound of revelry. But to Joshua, his best guess as to what's happening is that there's war taking place. And I think that that's indicative of a reality, that there's a sense in which there is a conflict that's taking place, but it's spiritual in nature. Moses responds, no, it's not the sound of war. And then in a piece of poetry, he says, it is not the sound of the cry of triumph, nor is it the sound of the cry of defeat. So it's not war, it's not winning a war, it's not losing a war, but the sound of singing that I hear. I'm not sure what to make of that. My suspicion is that if I were smarter, I'd be able to figure out what's going on there. But I suspect something is going on there with that wording. Moses then, looking at what's happening, he's angered. He sees the calf, he sees the people dancing, and he's angry. Now, the singing and dancing isn't necessarily wrong. If you remember back to what happened right after the crossing of the Red Sea, the people of Israel gathered and they celebrated. And they sang a song. Remember, Miriam sang a song, and there was dancing. And there was no indication that that was wrong. So the singing and dancing in and of itself is not wrong. It's in the context that makes it wrong. And Moses can tell that this is not, what he's seeing is not healthy. It's not good. It's interesting that the word that's used for shouting, they shouted in verse 17, is written with an old spelling, such that the letters in this particular word correspond exactly to in verse 12, where it says, why should the Egyptians speak, saying, with evil intent? The word with evil intent is spelled the same way as shouted is in verse 17. Now it's Umberto Casuto that noted that. He notes such things. He pays close attention to such things. There are two or three places in this passage where the author uses old spellings of words to make them look like another word in the passage. And this is one of those. So Moses is angry. He throws the tablets down and busts them up. What he did by throwing them down was an act which captured what was actually happening, and that is the contract that had been made between God and the people of Israel was broken. They had broken the contract. So Moses broke the tablets. It is interesting that in Akkadian legal terminology, the term to break the tablet means to invalidate or repudiate a document of agreement. I was wondering, I wonder where our expression to break to break a contract. I wonder if it's related to this in somehow. I don't know the answer to that. Moses then destroys the idol. He burned it, and in all likelihood, what's being burned there would be the wood that's underneath the metal. Then he ground it into powder. So he's taking the metal that's left, he grinds that down into powder. And Sarna points out, it is now clear from the Ugaritic myth that recounts the destruction of the god Mat by the goddess Anath, that the same cumulative series of destructive acts presents a picture of total annihilation. Similar obliterative exercises are featured in both the Egyptian and Mesopotamian sources. And there can be no doubt that the purpose was to reduce the obnoxious object to absolute non-existence. So he has completely obliterated this calf, this idol. Then he takes the dust and he sprinkles that on water and he has the people drink it. Now, why did Moses do this? Why does he sprinkle his stuff on water and have them drink it? There are four different solutions to this that I have been able to find. The first is that it's like a test for adultery. So as is described in Numbers 5, 11 through 31, if someone is suspected of adultery, then they are to take dust from the floor of the tabernacle, sprinkle it on water, and have the suspected perpetrator drink it. It's not clear what happens when they drink it, how you can tell from them drinking it whether adultery was committed or not. There are some people that speculate that if there was swelling of the body, that indicates that adultery was committed. I don't know. I mentioned before that there are several suggestions in this chapter that what is happening is adultery-like. And one of the best indicators of that is that three times as we go through the chapter, and I think these are all in next week's section, there are three times that what was done here is referred to as, quote, a great sin. That term, a great sin, is used in Akkadian and Egyptian texts to refer to adultery. That appears to be a synonym for adultery. This is from Sarna. He says, it is pertinent to point out that our narrative contains more than a hint of this same metaphor. Three times it stamps the making of and worshiping at the calf, a great sin. It so happens that this phrase is a legal term found in Akkadian documents from Ugarit and in Egyptian marriage contracts, and it always refers to adultery. Otherwise, all biblical usages of the term great sin refer to idolatry. It is reasonable, therefore, to perceive in Moses' action a strong intimation of a parallel with the suspected adulteress. Quite likely, the potion administered to all the Israelites had as its purpose to determine the guilty ones, presumably the 3,000 who subsequently lost their lives. So that's one explanation for why Moses ground up the idol and had them drink it. The second is as a punishment. They have to drink this disgusting mixture as punishment. Third, as a cleansing ritual, like the red cow in Numbers 19. And the fourth, to punish the calf, people ingest and expel it as waste. The gold that constituted the idol is effectively gone. I lean heavily towards the first explanation. I think that fits well. I don't know how that test for a suspected adulteress works. And I don't know how it worked in this instance either. But I think that, as it turns out, that this probably was a way of indicating who the guilty parties were. And as we'll see, those who are guilty are going to be put to death. Okay, that's where I cut the chapter in half in my outline. So I will stop there, and we've got lots of time for questions, if there are questions.
Thanks, David. In 31:13, where he says, "You shall surely observe my Sabbaths," why is that plural?
Well, I assume it's that you will surely observe the Sabbath on a regular basis, and the Sabbath on a regular basis turns out to be several instances of the Sabbath.
So he's talking about the future, not any other holy days that he's going to institute.
I couldn't say that for sure, because there are other, there's called the Sabbath year, there are Sabbaths that for other occasions. But I think he's talking about the weekly Sabbath. That's because he ties it into the creation account.
So then he's promising them a future of some sort. I mean,
what are you thinking?
Well, if he's saying Sabbaths plural, then he's sort of, it seems like he's saying, for the rest of your lives, always observe my Sabbaths, for the rest of your kingdom, for the rest of your history.
Right.
Don't ever forget this one.
Right.
And the other thing was, Moses, and I may be going Charlton Heston here, I'm not sure, but Moses breaking the tablets, it feels like Moses is identifying more with God than he is with the people, and he takes it as a personal disappointment. A coach gets really upset when the players fail, but it's their failure, not his. They haven't failed him. Mm-hmm. In this case, they haven't failed Moses, they failed God. Mm-hmm. But Moses is really upset about it. Mm-hmm. Like, he's invested in this, in the outcome.
Right. I think that's true. But to say that he's identifying more with God than with the people, I don't think that's right. And that's one of the things that I'll be talking about more next week. And that's what has shocked me, is Moses, at this point, fully identifies with the people. And as we go through, I think you'll see that that's the case. So Moses is in this position where there's a sense in which he fully identifies with God, and he fully identifies with the people of Israel. He is smack dab in the middle.
So for him, is he saying the contract has been broken? And so he's just acknowledging that by breaking
it? I think that's right.
Okay.
I think he's just, it's a physical act that expresses what has actually happened. The people have broken the contract.
Hi, David. A couple
Hi.
Questions. Do we know, like, was just the 10 Devarim that are on the tablets, or is it more than that?
It's possible it's more than that, but it seems to me that the thing that fits best with the words that we see at various places throughout this text, that it is just the 10 commandments that are on those tablets.
It is interesting that, I mean, at least 4 or 5 of those are transgressed in this one moment in time, in terms of, you know, you shall have no other god, you shall not make an idol, you shall not, profane the name of God, mm-hmm. etc. Mm-hmm. Adultery. Is that something that the commentators are saying anything about? Is that like a thing?
Mm-hmm. Yes. But I'll talk about this more next week. Okay. But a slick lawyer approaching things from the perspective of Aaron could make the case that none of the laws were broken.
I'll look forward to next week. just a couple more questions, and I know Jack's got his hand up there. But so you mentioned the Egyptian god Mot or Mot. Sarna yes. thinks that that's what these people have created. Is that is
no,
that,
no, no?
Am
no.
I wrong about that?
No. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is that was a section where. He was making the argument that these words that are used to describe what Moses did to this idol suggest that that idol was completely destroyed, was completely obliterated, and those same words are used in the in context in Egyptian literature and Ugaritic literature where clearly that's what's intended.
Okay, yeah. For some reason, I thought that he, in another section, suggests that what they're making is an Egyptian god that they are familiar with who can take them back to Egypt. Is that part of...
I don't think so.
Okay.
And I'll explain what I think is going on next week, but the slick lawyer is going to say... they didn't make a god at all.
Okay. And I'm going to hand this back over to Dick as I ask my last question. It's Aaron really comes across like just like kind of like a simpleton here. Like, you know, especially in what he's about to say. Threw it in the fire and how comes this idol?
Right.
So can you speak to that, or are you going to speak more to it next week?
Well, I'll talk about it more next week, but my take on this is that, well, first I'll note, there's no indication that Aaron is reprimanded for this, which I think is very interesting. I think what happened is Aaron was intimidated, and having been intimidated, and I think he's genuinely afraid for his life and probably has good reason to be so. So what he's trying to do is think, okay, well, would it be so wrong to do what they're asking? And he's trying to conceive of it in a way that it's okay. And I think he has successfully, in his own mind, come up with a way of explaining it where it's theologically okay. We'll talk about that more next week. But I think he was afraid. And once things start going, he can see that he's casting it in this certain way, but that's not what people are doing. They're obviously thinking about it differently, and then that kind of scares him. And he sees it getting out of control, but he doesn't know what to do about it.
Okay, you've already told us you're going to talk about it next week, but you said Aaron could make the case that none of the commandments, even the one about a graven image,
yes.
Wow. Okay. And then the other question is, just to be clear about what you're saying, they're not doing anything whatsoever that is overtly and explicitly contrary to the worship of Yahweh. Right? That's what you're suggesting?
Yes and no. I'm saying that a slick lawyer could come in and explain everything that they are doing in a way that would be theologically acceptable.
Okay, I guess what's behind my question is that kind of weird little phrase, they stood up to play. I've always assumed that that was probably something that was just clearly and obviously and blatantly a part of pagan, the worship of heathen gods, that maybe involved revelry, drunkenness, like a bacchanalia, maybe even literally sexual immorality, right at the base of the idol and that kind of stuff. That's not the case? Right?
That's possible. It all depends. I mean, the word doesn't tell us that.
Right.
But that word could be used to describe some practices later on in the Old Testament into some practices that would fit your description. But this is much earlier than that. We don't know whether that word has those connotations at the time that Exodus is written. It does take on those connotations later. That's true.
So it sounds to me like, from Aaron's perspective, when all is said and done, what he intended, at least, even if it got out of hand, but what he intended, at least, was that nothing would be contrary to the worship, the true worship of Yahweh. If we grant that and assume that that's the case, then Moses and God are simply reading the hearts of the people? Is that okay?
I think so. I think so. Yeah. Aaron's case is going to be, it all depends on what is means, right? It's that kind of thing. It's exactly how you parse everything is going to be his defense. But I think clearly from God's perspective, this was all out of hand. This was all wrong. There's nothing good in it. Nothing redeemable in it.
Thanks, David.
Uh-huh.
Do you see any reason besides commentary for why the old spelling of singing would be used to correspond to with evil intent?
Any reason?
For example, the author wanting to suggest that this celebratory singing was not pure of heart.
Right. That's. I think Kasuda was probably right there, that what was intended by the author was to associate evil intent earlier with evil intent here. The shouting that's taking place, there is evil intent behind that.
Thanks.
And that's part of what Jack was talking about, reading the hearts. And I think that's, I mean, if I'm right, it was that's what kind of blew me away is, most of the commentaries say that they were just blatantly violating the Ten Commandments. But as I looked at it more carefully, I was thinking, you know, if you squint just right, you could say, no, we aren't. But what's happening is God is looking at what's going on in their hearts, and this stinks to high heaven. This is all wrong.
So in a way, the author might be doing for us, the readers, what God was doing by looking in their hearts and assigning some motives to these otherwise benign actions.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Just looking at the two characters of Moses and Aaron. And well, chronologically, is Aaron supposedly older than Moses?
He's the older
brother, and Moses got the leadership job from God.
Right.
And Moses said that he wasn't capable of speaking to Pharaoh, so Aaron's the one with the mouth, he's the mouthpiece. And yet their characters, Moses, he could have said, okay, I'd love to be the progenitor of the people, but he doesn't. He pleads for God. And Aaron's the one that is just very weak leader, which it's interesting when he's the high priest, and it kind of makes me think, you know, high priests don't have that job because of their character. it's their lineage and their kind of appointment by God, and all of that's just kind of a mystery. You know, it shows in a way God's mercy rather than his picking the best qualified. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's the whole thing is kind of...
No, it is fascinating. And that's part of what I want to talk about next week, too, is Moses develops over time. We see a lot more development in him than I had ever seen before. And he develops into something that is really remarkable. We don't see that same kind of thing happening with Aaron.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you first started talking, I thought, I've always wondered about Aaron, how he got off so easy with this. You know, all these people are killed, and he's the one that, well, this calf just came out of the fire. I mean,
Happens all the time.
How did he get off so easy? But you'll talk about it next tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was just a real weakling, maybe, and God was merciful because he was
weak. I think that's
right.
I think that's right. That he's basically cowardly, and God was merciful towards him.
I was thinking the same thing that Jan was, every time I've read this thing on Aaron. But then I did some looking up here. But at least God said to Aaron and Moses both together that they would not be allowed to go into the promised land.
Hmm.
I don't know. But anyway. But my question is, where we first started off today with the Sabbath and what God thought of the Sabbath or wanted the people to think of the Sabbath, how serious he was about it, what the penalty was when you didn't observe it. But then, you know, we have the Ten Commandments, and you can kind of go through them and, you know, honor your father and your mother and not covet. And we have to try to translate and think about what that means to us today. Some of them are fairly cut and dry, but others aren't. And some of them, it seems like we accept and emphasize more, but others we don't. And the one that, of course, that I'm thinking about is remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy.
Right.
And how, when you read something like this in the Old Testament and then you try to apply it to what I should think about what God is saying there and how to apply it, it's not real clear. And I can see that there's been a big change just in my lifetime. I mean, a huge change.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if you can comment a little bit on, you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Basically, what you're saying is, should we keep the Sabbath?
Yes, yeah. Or how should that be done?
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's
because
a great...
Because there's laws that it seems like we've kind of put aside, but there's a reason and a value for them, and I see those eroding, and pretty soon you have basically nothing.
Yep. No, I understand what you're talking about. And looking at this time, kind of, you know, brought that all up in my mind as well. A perpetual statute. And this is, and anybody who violates it is cut off from their people, and they die. This is all stuff that I am in the process of sorting out, because I've observed the same kind of thing that you're talking about, of, and I would guess that you've experienced the same thing, that culturally, if you give way on certain values, if you compromise certain values, there's kind of a domino effect, and other values start to erode away too. And after a while, you look back and go, how'd that all happen? And it's not good, some of it. And so that issue of how do we hold the line on what is right and true, what does that dictate to us then what we should do? And that's a difficult question. And it is something that I'm I'm thinking about and rethinking and trying to figure out. With respect to the Sabbath in particular, the question is it to be fulfilled perpetually, generation after generation, in form, or is it symbolic of something that can be kept without keeping the form? You see what I'm saying? And I don't know the answer to that question. The answer, I mean, it could be yes or it could be no. I'm still sorting this stuff out myself. But that's what gets difficult about these. And if I go back to when I was talking about the law in Exodus, I really do think that the law that was given by Moses should be thought about like we think about the commandments that are given by a parent to a child, and that some of those change over time. I could hear myself saying to my children, I don't want you ever to cross the street without holding my hand. And yet now they cross the street every day without holding my hand. So it's tough. You have to sort all this stuff out and figure out, why was this law given? And how does that fit into all that God is doing? And therefore, what does that dictate that I should do today? And that's a big project. That's a difficult project. But I think it's a very important project. It's one that we all need to be engaged in and trying to sort out. So it comes down to better understanding what the Sabbath is all about. Why did God do it in the first place? And then, therefore, what would it dictate that we do?
Obviously, you can keep the Sabbath for wrong reasons.
Sure.
And you can substitute something else for the Sabbath. I mean, you can make a case for substituting a different form for the Sabbath for all the right reasons.
Right.
But it's just interesting for the slippage. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. that's mm-hmm. when you think of the Jewish people who for centuries and centuries and centuries kept their Jewish form by following what they thought it meant to be a Jew. And then later they come from all over the different parts of the world and stuff and still have can still recognize each other as a Jew just mm-hmm. because of the way that they, but they could still be doing that for all the wrong reasons.
Sure.
I mean,
anything can be done for the wrong reasons.
Right, yeah.
Right. So the question is, and you use the term make a case for X. I think it's really important that we understand that it's not a matter of making a case for, because a case can be made for lots of different things, but to actually resolve in our own minds what is most likely the case, what does God most likely want us to do and why? Understand that whole thing as best we possibly can. And that's critical. I'll just make one comment. I have argued, and I'll point out, I will reiterate, I got this from my daughter. She's the first one who suggested this. I think she's right. But as far as I know, we're the only two people in existence that think this is right. But I think that all of the Jewish festivals, the seven Jewish biblical festivals, can be mapped onto events in Exodus. We just had Rosh Hashanah, which is the festival of trumpets, and I think, if I'm right, then that maps onto Joshua saying he heard the sound of the people as they shouted. And Yom Kippur is coming up this next week. And if I'm right, then that festival maps onto the three times that Moses appeals to God for mercy for the Israelites. And we've had one of those. Next week there'll be the other two. So we'll be talking about that next week. But since those holidays are right at hand, I just wanted to make that comment. Okay, thanks.